RadioInfluence.com.
Welcome to the Tennis with an Accent podcast. I am Matt Zemek with my partner Saqib Ali. And the 2018 tennis season is well and truly over now that the Davis Cup final has concluded. The final Davis Cup final, at least for the time being. Croatia 3, France 1. Marin Cilic won two singles matches. Borna Coric won a third. The French won the doubles, but it wasn't enough. Cilic with rock-solid performances on Friday and then the reverse singles on Sunday closed down the Davis Cup championship for Croatia. Croatia becomes the 10th Davis Cup nation to win multiple Davis Cup championships, and now tennis moves into a new and uncertain future with its international competitions, with its parade of new cups, so to speak, the ATP Cup, and then the event that I'm going to call the PK Cup, along with a lot of other tennis observers around the world. It's not really Davis Cup. It's Gerard Piqué's new baby. So tennis is splitting into all sorts of new and different directions, as tennis is wont to do. And let's address some of these tension points. And a starting point, Saqib, is simply the 70-minute conversation you had with Mark Woodford, an ITF board member, as well as a doubles legend, on last week's episode. I just want to get some of your thoughts unpacking that interview and some of the impressions that still remain with you a week later. After being able to digest that interview, what are your impressions of your conversation with Mark Woodford?
Hello, everyone. And yeah, definitely, Matt, this podcast, like I want to just share with the audience how it took place. I met Woodford in Newport, and we had spoken on the podcast a couple of times, and I'd also met him at the Open last year. So I just mentioned the idea of Davis Cup, not thinking that I'll invite him for a podcast, and he sounded so pro for the decision. And a lot of people who I've interacted with on Twitter and as well on the podcast were of the opinion and the notion that no change was needed. So him being an Aussie, it was an automatic that, you know, we should use this platform for the other side of the argument. And he's part of the ITF, you know, committee in some capacity. And he was very eager to come and give his side of the story. And finally, you know, we were here just after the Djokovic-Zverev final concluded. Me and Mark finally, you know, got our timetables matching, more for his because he travels a lot. And I think as far as you said, you know, it was hard to process some of impactful things he was saying, because I was still trying to engage a conversation and, you know, come up with some responding questions. But definitely a few things stayed with me after this podcast is now more than a week old. And one thing is for sure, when he compared ATP's new creation, the ATP Cup, or the ATP Team Cup, World Team Cup, which was played in Dusseldorf, Germany till 2012, and now returns in the ATP calendar, which is already crowded. This time it returns with, you know, points, and it also is going to be, you know, one of the three or four, you know, team events on the calendar, because Hopman Cup is, you know, and it's, you know, still there in Australia, and then Laver Cup, Roger Federer and Tony Gottschalk's brainchild, and then there's Gerard Piqué Cup, which is going to be the new version of Davis Cup. So, yeah, I was pretty surprised when Woodford termed ATP Cup as exhibition, putting him in the same bracket as the Laver Cup. And then, of course, you know, his stance on how some of the nations are not really coming out on good terms, like financially, with this home and away scenario, which is so dear to a lot of us. And then, of course, the other part of the conversation which preceded the Davis Cup chat was his views on Sasha Zverev and how Zverev should use his weight by making such arguments and should back it up by wise scheduling. And Zverev's not alone. And we agreed that, you know, players do change. And I also had mentioned a small incidents when I was in Miami and Zverev did actually like the new version. When I asked him that question in a small press room after he had beaten Medvedev. So now let me turn this over to you, since you listen to the podcast, and what are your impressions that that have stayed with you even after this podcast is, you know, a week old? A lot of our friends have discussed in some capacity with us. Feedback has been decent. So walk me through what has stayed with you since we released this last Tuesday.
One of the main snapshots from this Davis Cup final was the sight of former French Tennis Federation president Bernard Giudicelli watching as his team, took a beating. And Giudicelli is not a very well-liked figure, and he shouldn't be because, well, he's corrupt. That's a widely acknowledged reality. He should have been pushed out a lot earlier than he did. And it was curious that he didn't step down until after the PK Cup had already been arranged and finalized. I think that the timing there was hardly innocent or accidental. I think it was very intentional. And so seeing Giudicelli on site in the front row, in his normal seat, just as he had been in the previous year's Davis Cup final, that it brings home a point from the Woodford podcast, namely that what is good for the tennis federations and good for the leaders and how they see and perceive various situations and the needs which arise from them often go against the wishes of the fans and the wishes of the larger masses in tennis. And the specific point in the Woodford interview that you did, and you did a fantastic job with it, Saqib, was that the tennis federations, when I speak of a tennis nation, I'm really talking about the leadership, the people in positions of power within a nation's structure of tennis governance. The people at the top of the food chain in a given tennis nation worry that they can't finance hosting Davis Cup ties within the home and away system. I'm not talking about the rich tennis nations, either the Grand Slam nations or also Spain, Germany, a few other nations you could readily think of, but the nations that are well down the totem pole. The fact that Woodford said that they those nations were not confident that they could, turn a profit in exchange for hosting a Davis Cup tie, that shocked me. And I mean, it shouldn't have shocked me, but it did, because I've grown up in the United States, and of course we don't have to worry about that sort of thing in our country. But to hear a different perspective from a different part of the globe, that was noteworthy. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that these federations in the less wealthy tennis nations are correct or enlightened, but it did represent a piece of the puzzle. And, it does sadden me that since fans in these other countries around the world want to be able to see big name tennis players playing in a first or second round Davis Cup tie or a zone group Davis Cup tie, now those fans, I mean, not 100%, but certainly in the elite group, where the Davis Cup championship is going to be decided, now the PK Cup championship, those fans aren't going to be able to see the high-end players. So it illustrates the difference between how a federation president sees the needs of tennis and how the fans do. And, if tennis was governed better, you would see those two sides being brought together, and tennis leaders and decision makers would think about how to unify those two strands. But in the current world that we have, in which tennis governance is really an oxymoron more than anything else, we have exactly the opposite. So that's the thing that struck me from the Woodford interview more than anything else. The federation's distaste for the home and away format, which runs contrary to what I think most fans want, which is to continue to be able to have that direct access to Davis Cup ties instead of having this neutral site event in Spain the next 2 years?
Yeah, I think the podcast was very well received. I'm not, you know, fully convinced of the counter argument that Woodford presented, but again, it's a different viewpoint, and he was very generous in his explanations, and also said, you know, big federations like Australia and US, and especially Australia, they pay their players, you know, a lot of money, and that may not be the case for some of the other federations. So let me just, you know, bring a relevant question about some of the powerful federations. Like France has been, you know, a key member and a very big exponent of, you know, this original format, and some of their players like Luca Pouille and even Yannick Noah, their outgoing Davis Cup captain, have been very vocal about, you know, the disdain they have for this change, and there is, you know, according to them, there was no need for this to be revamped. But just purely from the tennis point of view, France has been a powerhouse, and I think for the last 15 or 20 years, they have been a factor. And if we compare them to the other strong team, which is Spain, but Spain has a superstar and an all-time legend in Rafael Nadal, who's been, you know, part of the victorious team three times. So if you compare the depth of these two teams, I know the competition is going to be a new format starting next year. Are you surprised that France could only win two times, or still two times in this generation is decent?
It's hard to say when looking that broadly at the issue. I would say that France has left some money on the table, but it's left some money on the table, so to speak, not necessarily through the prism of its depth, but more through the prism of Gasquet and Tsonga and Monfils not having the careers that they had. And this is a part of the Davis Cup versus tour competition conversation, Saqib, that is really fascinating to explore in all of its layers. You know, how does Davis Cup performance feed into tour performance and vice versa? It's really a chicken and egg kind of question. And I think that when looking at the French team, it's more about, you know, how these various French notables, you know, who've won over 400 matches in a number of cases, how those tour wins and those tour careers in important moments and important matches did not become everything that they could have been, or perhaps one could say should have been. And so I think that the French tendency to underperform at the tour level has something to do with only winning, you know, a couple Davis Cup championships instead of several more, with that deep bench and also with world-class doubles. So it's not necessarily, to me, a matter of France coming up short in Davis Cup. I think the larger story there would just be France coming up short in general. So it's not as though France should have won Davis Cup in a narrow prism or a narrow frame of reference. It's more about the French tennis stars not reaching their ceilings or not going as highly as they could have with the talent they possess. I think that's probably the better read on that situation.
Fair enough, even though I would like to slightly disagree, purely on the notion, because we've seen in tennis, especially when players are playing for their nation, be it the Olympic Games or, you know, the coveted, you know, Davis Cup, players have, you know, sometimes, you know, played inspired tennis to their partisan crowds, and they've risen to the occasion. Again, the cliche is they punch above their weight. And, you know, we've seen many players like Nicolas Massou going on to win the gold medal, and then even Marc Rosset back then, and Miroslav Mišer in 1988, and you name it, till, you know, Rafa Nadal and, Andy Murray. And some of these guys started, you know, playing for medals. It has usually been some inspired performances by, you know, some lesser names in tennis. And same for Davis Cup. We had, like, you know, Luca Pouille, again, is not a lesser name, but, you know, he was pretty instrumental last year. Then we've had Mikhail Yuzny play some, you know, great matches, and vice versa. So let me quickly bring in Marin Cilic here. He's already a great player, you know, and if we leave those four guys, out of, you know, the comparison context here, because, you know, a lot of time the comparison runs through them and you can't escape those shadows. But Cilic is pretty decent. He's already a major winner, won a Masters 1000 not too long ago in Cincinnati. So do you think some of the mixed bag results that he's had since Wimbledon, you think this could re-engage, you know, some of his status as, you know, as a force? Because we know he's like top eight. He's gone to London a few years in a row. Again, that's a big fix that he needs to, you know, rectify his record there. But overall, do you think this could be a platform? A lot of time the conversation is you win something. And of course, Djokovic and Murray can't be used in my mind because, you know, they're anomalies, because they were having a great year before they even won Davis Cup. So you think for Cilic, could this be a stepping stone, or you don't buy into this kind of conversation that this is a team event, he played with his teammates? You know, of course, a win is a win, but really won't serve him any different when the season rolls around.
Yeah, the thing with Cilic, and so I would say that this is not going to be any sort of stepping stone. I think it's more about what it represents within the flow, such as it is, of Cilic's career. This event is powerful in that it shows that whenever you are ready to write off Marin Cilic and discount him and think about all the times that he falls short, most notably at the ATP finals where, you know, he hasn't yet made the semis. He struggled in that event despite being a generally good indoor player. Just when you are ready to get sour on him, he does something really sweet. And this is just the latest example. You know, so Cilic, he's been a regular part of the top 10, but in terms of how he handles big tournaments, you know, it's very hit and miss. You know, he was down at Wimbledon, but he had the great run at the Australian Open. He had a solid French Open where he's made a few quarterfinals in recent years, but then he had the perplexing U.S. Open quarterfinal loss to Kei Nishikori, in which he was up a set and a break midway through set two, and then lost the handle of that match. And it was a disappointing end to his season at the majors. And then all the times in the second half of 2018, in which he started really well. You know, the first set he played against Nadal in the Toronto quarterfinal was, you know, one of the best sets anyone has played all year on the ATP tour, but yet he couldn't finish that match, and he blew a number of other leads late in sets. He had a number of opponents on the ropes, but couldn't finish them off. So, you know, Cilic, he's a regular presence in the top 10. He's a regular presence in big matches, but that regular presence doesn't manifest itself in an every week kind of way. It's more that he'll go through a lull for a few months or a few tournaments, and then he'll do really well. So it's up and down. Now, over the course of a full tennis season, it amounts to a pretty solid resume with his Australian Open final, his championship in Queens when he beat Djokovic in an excellent match, and then making the ATP finals, and then getting this Davis Cup championship for Croatia with help from Borna Coric, not only in the Davis Cup final, but also in the semifinals against the United States in September. So Cilic, just when you're ready to look upon him in a negative way, he does something special. And then, of course, there's the flip side. Just when you think, he's arrived, or he's figuring it out, and you think he's going to stay at this higher plateau, you know, then he suffers the bad loss, such as to Guido Pella at Wimbledon, you know, just weeks after his victory over Djokovic. So ultimately, Saqib, with Cilic, I think the main thing to say, and it's a positive one because he has been doing a lot of positive things over the past 2 years, is that, you know, after the 2014 U.S. Open, when he caught fire in the second week of that tournament in New York, it was easy to think, okay, where had this been the past several years? And when you remember that 2014 U.S. Open, one detail that's important is that his drug suspension, which kept him away from the tour for several months, that was in the year and a half preceding that U.S. Open. So his legs were comparatively fresher than much of the competition at the U.S. Open that year. And it's interesting to note that, because 1 year earlier at the U.S. Open in 2013, you had Rafa winning the U.S. Open after also winning Canada and Cincinnati. So the Rafa pulled off the Canada-Cincinnati U.S. Open triple. Rafa's injury for several months had kept him away from the tour. It wasn't for a suspension or any kind of disciplinary reason, but you know, seeing Cilic win that U.S. Open 1 year after Rafa won the U.S. Open after extended time off from tour, that told me, I don't know about anybody else, but it told me that, you know, this seemed like an unusual event. If Cilic had been playing on the tour constantly throughout 2014 without a long suspension, I don't think he would have won that 2014 U.S. Open. So I didn't discount that win, but I diminished its value, and I diminished its value at the time by expressing great skepticism that Cilic would replicate those results or at least come close to doing so. But with it, what he's done in the past 2 years, and this Davis Cup performance over the weekend being just the latest example, I think Cilic has firmly silenced that kind of criticism. He's firmly refuted me and the doubts that I had about him 4 years ago. He has become something much more than just the guy who caught fire that second week of the 2014 U.S. Open. I think that's the thing we really need to appreciate about how Cilic has improved his legacy.
For sure. And I think I would just like to add to what you said. I think he's also the best Croat right now. If you look at his former coach and Goran, and you know, former top player from Croatia, Goran Ivanišević, who reached a career high of number two and played four Wimbledon finals before finally winning his elusive title in 2001. Cilic, on the other hand, has replicated his major success by reaching a major final on three different occasions. You know, French Open is the only tournament where he hasn't done it yet, and he's played a couple of quarterfinals. However, Ivanišević was a much better fast court player, as he did reach the year-end finales, semis three times, and you know, he was a great indoor player. And Cilic, even though he's a decent indoor player himself, has to, I think, you know, rectify, as we both have said, that record. You know, that's kind of a blemish for his big game at the O2 Arena. But I think at age 30, it's fair to say that he may have a couple more looks at least if he maintains, you know, even you know, the form he has had this year. So yeah, and then we can definitely look at another player, you know, in from France, like Lucas Pouille. Again, I know you are not too keen on the Pouille stock, but last year Pouille had this amazing, you know, performance in Davis Cup, and he started the year with somewhat decent results, you know, at least till February, and then he just tailed off. So what do you see of his stance quickly of not playing the Davis Cup, and then how do you see his upcoming season? I know he's, you know, there's not much to write about his form, but you think he's some guy like who can just, you know, play without pressure, since, you know, not many eyes would be on him in terms of, you know, how his form has been?
Well, I think he needs to learn to play without pressure. It's worth recalling in this 2018 ATP season, his match against Karen Khachanov at the French Open. You know, that was played on court Philippe Chatrier. And from what I saw of that match, and I saw about 1.5 to 2 sets of that match, you know, switching around the various matches that we were covering at Tennis with an Accent. And I recall Pouille's shot selection being typically erratic and all over the map. There were so many poor shot choices from Pouille that day against Khachanov, and you know, that is to me representative of what I see from Pouille so often. There he loses quite a few matches that he might not necessarily should have won, but he easily could have won. A good example from 2017, the previous year, was his mid tournament match against Diego Schwartzman at the U.S. Open. You know, that to me was a match that he should have taken care of, but he didn't. So, you know, Puy, like so many other French players, and I know that this risks being seen or perceived by listeners as a stereotype, but it really is true. You know, Joe Wilisanga, Gaël Monfils, they are brilliant athletes, but their shot selection, shot choice really is, it really and truly is a common theme with them, that they struggle to play the percentage shot at the right time. They try and hit the beautiful shot, the beautiful winner, instead of the bread and butter form of tennis, which elicits an error, a forced error from their opponent. You know, there are many ways to win a point, and being really good in professional tennis often comes down to having more ways to win a point than your opponent. And French players often surrender this advantage. They play their chess pieces so aggressively early in a match, and then all their pawns get swiped and they're left with a very barren board, and they just get overtaken by an opposition that has more resources, more ways to get from point A to point B. So Puy fits right into that. And I think that, you know, playing with less pressure enables you to think and process matches and shots and patterns more clearly. That's what he needs to get to have the kind of fulfilling career that his talent suggests he can still have. But until that shot selection improves, he's not going to get where he wants to go.
Yeah, we'll see. Definitely. I agree. He's left a lot to be desired, and the game is there, but some things have to come together for his game to flourish, you know, in the capacity that, you know, at least some of us expect. But yeah, that's going to be another intriguing story come next year.
So, Saqib, you know, in terms of continuing a conversation about Davis Cup, I'm struck, you know, by how the way Davis Cup is processed and thought about in, you know, rich tennis nations compared to tennis nations which aren't at the forefront of the global tennis radar. And so, you know, you grew up in India. I'm interested in how Davis Cup is processed there, and also not just Davis Cup, but also the Olympics. You know, when we think of someone like Leander Paes, who has a number of different significant accomplishments in tennis across the board, and also, you know, some on the singles side, most of them on the doubles side, but he's won in various and different tennis competitions. You know, when you, and I know that you've lived in the United States for roughly the past quarter century, but nevertheless, you have roots in India, and I know that you're still very much in tune with the way that the Indian tennis audience thinks about tennis. You know, when you consider a career such as Leander Paes, what do you think is the first sentence in a career summation or a career evaluation about Paes? Is it what he's done as a doubles player at the major tournaments, or is Davis Cup and also the Olympics the first thing that an Indian tennis fan is likely to associate with him? What is the balance or the mixture in terms of how Indian tennis fans relate to and remember Leander Paes?
Look, it's no secret. I think no matter where, majority of the fans identify the success on tour. You know, the patriotic side, you know, the home country, the flag, these are all good. But tennis is a, you know, a very individual sport. That being said, I think Leander has done exceptionally well representing India in, you know, what, five Olympics, or and then he's been such a pillar for Davis Cup. But let's not make any mistake when his name is mentioned, especially from a journalistic point of view, or even fans discussing his bronze medal in the 96 Atlanta Olympics is the highlight, even though he's won Wimbledon Junior in singles, and then in 99 he won the doubles event with Mahesh Bhupathi. But I think those are some of the defining moments. And even before him, the great servants of Indian tennis, Ramesh Krishnan and Vijay Amritraj, they were, you know, pillars of Davis Cup, and they led India to the Davis Cup final in 1987 when we were swept by Sweden, you know, the Edberg Wilander team, 5-0 on clay. But India did really well. That was, I think, their second Davis Cup final, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, again, I mean, I'll throw this back to you, because tennis is a global sport, and countries like India have accepted when we haven't had, like, top-notch single representation, and very few nations have over the history. of tennis. So it's a global game. You know, I grew up as a Becker fan, and my friends were Edberg fans, and vice versa. It was Agassi, Sampras, and I'm sure right now Sanket and some of our friends can say it's pretty clearly the big three. So, you know, and a lot of your following on Twitter is of Indian origin, and Indians do value tennis. They have a lot of passion. But compared to someone who grew up in the States like yourself, what is your balance like when it compares to the tour success and the majors versus, you know, nation pride and Davis Cup and Olympics?
Well, I have to begin by telling just my story as a sports fan and a tennis fan. I have to admit that I used to be someone who was not really a tennis diehard. I had to grow into that. And that period of growth came with the arrival of Federer and Nadal. That really turned me into a tennis diehard. I think that before 2003, 4, 5, then the arrival of Rafa, the arrival of Djokovic, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s, you know, I was what could reasonably considered not a tennis diehard, but more like an American sports fan who also liked tennis. You know, there's a difference between the tennis diehard who really focuses on that sport and then a sports fan who also happens to like tennis. So I was in that latter group. So I grew up with Dick Enberg and Bud Collins at breakfast at Wimbledon. My first tennis memory was Jimmy Connors beating John McEnroe in five sets in the 1982 Wimbledon final. That was my first introduction to tennis. And so, like a lot of other American sports fans who happen to like tennis, you know, as one small part of a larger love of sports, tennis really was widely visible and widely talked about twice a year. Once was Wimbledon, and the other time was the US Open. Wimbledon maintained visibility for a lot of casual American sports fans who also like tennis because that's the time of the year when the NBA finals have just ended in mid-June. The NHL Stanley Cup finals also end in mid-June. The NFL, which is America's number one most popular sport, that doesn't start until September. So in July, there's really not a whole lot going on most years. And remember that in the 1980s, soccer had not become very popular in the United States. So the landscape was a lot more barren than it is now. And so Wimbledon really did receive a ton of attention. The big American sports writers traveled across the pond. So that tournament got play. And then, of course, the U.S. Open in New York for 2 weeks, helped along by that memorable Super Saturday, September 8th, 1984, with Lendl and Cash, Martina and Chris, Jimbo and Johnny Mack. You know, for three matches, the maximum number of sets, 13 sets possible. You know, both of the men went five sets. The women's match went three. You know, nearly 12 hours of tennis. All those factors made, you know, Wimbledon and the U.S. Open really the two points in time during the 1980s and early to mid 90s. Those were the focal points of a tennis year in America. So while Pete Sampras had that incredible Davis Cup moment in Russia, and while other American players, you know, such as John McEnroe, you know, became Davis Cup warriors at the highest level, even though such Davis Cup achievements existed for, you know, legendary American players, it's the major tournaments, and it's especially Wimbledon and the U.S. Open that really cement your name, not in terms of a tennis diehard's own record books and own points of emphasis, but they cement your name in a mainstream mass media ecosystem in the United States. So it's always been the majors. It's always been Wimbledon and the U.S. Open in particular. And Davis Cup really has not had that media traction, which is part of how you get your name associated with Davis Cup. You know, you need that national culture to elevate your place in the Davis Cup story and to also elevate the place of Davis Cup itself. And in a modern American context, that doesn't exist. You know, I need to say one more thing, Saqib. before the advent of the Open era in 1968, you know, the Davis Cup was either an Australian or an American dominated event. And so without the professionals playing at the major tournaments, you know, that was a different time in the evolution of the Davis Cup and how much it mattered to Americans and to the United States. But in the 1980s and 1990s, you know, that era of tennis and the Davis Cup's history had long since passed. So it really has gone through stages. But for someone such as myself and people of my generation and younger generations who grew up in either in the 1980s or later, it's all been about the majors for American tennis players.
And I think it's a fair point that you make, but even going back to the Indian origin, I firmly of the opinion that had Pace or even Krishnan or Amrit Raj before them, had they contested a major final, that would have been the defining talking point of their illustrious careers, not to shortchange Davis Cup or Olympics. You know, India has cricket, you know, as a big time sport and field hockey. So it was always that national view that, you know, we support, you know, our teams. But when it came to tennis, you know, I think the fans were quickly to identify that it's about the majors, it's about the tour. And same example, like Boris Becker, like who, you know, channeled a whole different generation of followers from, you know, from my time. And believe me, he's still known as a Wimbledon champion, even though people forget that in 1988, in indoor clay, he led Germany with Charlie Strieb and Erik Jellin winning 4-1 over the Swedish side that had Willander, Järryd, and Edberg and Nyström. So that's quite a mean feat, going in Sweden's den and winning on indoor clay. But you know what? He's still known as a guy who has not won a clay title when he's won 3 Wimbledon and 17 or Wimbledon champion. So I think you raised some interesting points with America. And I think even Woodford said Australia is a nation that values Davis Cup along with the majors. I would even spin this argument saying a country like Argentina, where you've seen legends like Diego Maradona show up for almost every Davis Cup tie. I think one of the recent great players, David Nalbandian, who in my book is one of the better talents to not have won a major. I think if you ever get a chance to ask Nalbandian, or if you can even dig some archived interviews, I think his regret of not winning Davis Cup is right up there with regret of not winning US Open. So I think it varies, you know, because in Argentina, tennis and, you know, clay tennis and Davis Cup, that's like a way of life. And that's why Del Potro was so emotional when he finally, you know, got that cup for them. And I think it's a fair question. If you are an Argentine fan listening to this podcast, drop a line to me and Matt, or even Tennis Accent, just saying, you know, what do you value more, the Del Potro 2009 US Open win or the Del Potro-led Davis Cup campaign? So I think, Matt, it's a very tricky conversation, but I think conclusively, again, I don't have any stats, but just by feeling the pulse of the game, I think no matter where you are, I think fans identify with major success. But unlike United States, that has such a history of great champions, a lot of us don't have the luxury of rooting for our own with a national, you know, point of view in tennis. So that's why it's a global sport, I think. And I know a lot of American friends who root for Federer when he's playing an American, and vice versa, same for Nadal. So I think that goes beyond. I think fans have accepted it's such a global affair. That's what I'm trying to say.
I think that's quite accurate. And I think that there's a specific wisdom in your point about how when you're in the United States or another particularly wealthy tennis nation, you know, that there will generally be either an ample supply or at least a few prominent examples of elite players. You know, you'll either have, you know, several players that have a chance to do really well at important tournaments, or you'll have a superstar. You know, there's a better chance in those elite tennis nations, and in the tennis nations which don't have as deep a crop of players, you know, and nations that, you know, need to work really well together, and we're talking especially about doubles, you know, those are the kinds of tennis rosters in which can come a little bit more to the forefront in Davis Cup, where the doubles point matters, but also you have coaching readily available coaching on court, And you also have, you know, the passions of, you know, national aspiration and the adrenaline. You know, we've seen that with Belgium making a recent Davis Cup final, and other nations, you know, making deeper runs than they had in previous decades. So when there isn't as large a supply of elite tennis players, you know, you get into some Davis Cup ties where, you know, if the talent is not overly imbalanced, you can have, you know, decent players punching a little bit above their weight and creating special memories, which precisely because of their underdog quality, precisely because those players aren't superstars, they might create a reaction and a level of satisfaction from fans that outstrips what you get in a major tournament. I mean, there's undeniably a certain level of enthusiasm and passion attached to like a Davis Cup upset, winning a Davis Cup tie you weren't supposed to win compared to, say, a Wimbledon third round match. Now, you know, obviously, when you carry that comparison across the board, there will obviously be some exceptions. Like, for example, Roger Federer beating Pete Sampras at Wimbledon in 2001. You know, so that was an earthquake. That was, you know, a single match upset that people will talk about for a very, very long time. But I'm not really talking about that kind of an upset when the victim is a super duper star. But I'm talking more about how a team of good but not spectacular Davis Cup tennis players, you know, advances through a bracket, makes a semifinal, makes a final when no one really expected it could happen. You know, when you're not in an elite tennis nation and you forge that kind of that unexpected parade of victories, it can carry a power in the public memory that you don't quite get for winning like a third or fourth round match at a major tournament. So I think that's an insight I really appreciated from you in that answer you gave.
And I would also like to conclude this conversation. It's pretty rich already by experience at French Open when I was there in 2016. I was with a friend of mine who was from Argentina, and he wanted his picture taken with Juan Monaco, who was, I think, a year away from retiring, I believe. And you know, he was such at the tail end of his career. I think he had just won his first round match. And there's a flurry of Argentine supporters who were watching him on an outside court. It was such a beautiful moment. I had to take, you know, my friend's picture, and Monaco was obliging every fan like he had won, you know, like he's made the last eight of the tournament. It was just the first match. Evening was almost turning into night. This was one of the last matches that was taking place, and it was just a beautiful moment. And this also gave me an idea that how knowledgeable the Argentine fans are, and they follow their players at this major. And this friend of mine told me that for them, this is the World Cup. This is like the World Cup of clay. And he said, all due respect to, you know, all the other tournaments, Wimbledon is great, but for them, French Open, like many Latin American countries, French Open is the deciding tournament. And they bring that, you know, that whole fandom with their flag and, you know, and the songs and the chanting. And, you know, they were like, I'm not saying there was a huge crowd, but it was one of the most, you know, memorable moments of my trip. I think a crowd of 20 odd, you know, on an outside court, and this fellow, you know, Monaco is obliging everyone with a picture. And I think that kind of translates when they play Davis Cup and Olympics, and some of the other countries have the same passion, but I guess they don't follow their players. And the example you use of Federer, I believe before Federer there was Hingis, but they weren't, I think, these, you know, Swiss fans before Roger and Wawrinka, who were traveling all over the world. And with Argentina, they had this culture, you know, even before Nalbandian and Del Potro.
Yeah, it really is a one-of-a-kind passion. And, you know, you had mentioned David Nalbandian earlier. And when I reflect on Nalbandian's career, you know, there were plenty of moments when you could see him get exasperated, and you could see him lose heart and lose faith. You know, you could also pinpoint the moments in his tour career, you know, when the pilot light began to recede. The 2006 Australian Open semifinal against Marcos Baghdatis. I mean, that to me is the match that, as a tour player, he never recovered from. But while his tour career featured several enormous disappointments and never really reached its potential, and he never could sustain the level that he showed in his best moments, such as when he made the 2002 Wimbledon final or won the 2005 Tennis Masters Cup in Shanghai against Federer. While his tour career was inconsistent, and you saw so much exasperation from him in a lot of his tour matches, in Davis Cup, you never really saw that from Nalbandian. You always saw him engaged. You always saw him fully attuned with a really large competitive appetite for victory. I think that the demeanor of Nalbandian, the way he attacked matches in Davis Cup, really was kind of an unspoken reflection of the extent to which he cared about that aspect of his career and that aspect of his tennis. Your comments about the Argentine passion for tennis on clay, to me, the connective tissue with Nalbandian is how much he cared about Davis Cup.
Yeah, I think we can definitely agree on that and end on this note and thank our partnership with Radio Influence, which is bringing our podcast through various platforms to a larger audience. And, you know, we are grateful and we enjoy this this new collaboration. And hopefully the listening experience has gotten better. And if you do listen to these podcasts, engage with me and Matt. And if you have opinions in Davis Cup on Chilich, Nalbandian, Becker, Pays, whatever we cover today, just drop a line and, you know, let's keep the conversation going. As according to us, there is no off season. We can engage more during this time. And Matt, final thoughts before we wrap this up.
Yeah, I just want to invite our listeners that, you know, during December, we're going to continue with these weekly podcasts. You know, it's the tennis off season, but we're not going to stop. We're going to keep delivering these weekly podcasts. So if you have ideas or if you have questions that you'd like us to explore, please feel free to contact us. Contact Saqib on Twitter at Saqiba, basically S-A-Q-I-B-A, his first name and his last initial. You can get me at my first initial and my last name, M. Zemek. That's where I am on Twitter. And you can also just send comments, input, questions to our Twitter account, our Tennis with an Accent Twitter account. That is @accent_tennis. And you can also read what we write at tennisaccent.com. So you can find us and our weekly podcast on Google Play, Stitcher, radioinfluence.com, and at Apple and iTunes, where we encourage you to subscribe, rate, and review. So Saqib, thank you for this weekly podcast. And we will keep doing these throughout the month of December, including Christmas and New Year's. So that's an invitation to us to come up with some creative stuff. And it's an invitation to our listeners to stay tuned throughout this tennis off season.
Thanks for listening and bye for now.
This is Bobby Sue Doyle-Hazard, host of Leveling the Playing Field, a podcast truly focused on women in the sports world. I'm so excited to bring this to you. It is for young women who are looking to get into the sports industry and women who are already in their careers, also looking to make a change. I want to put a spotlight on the amazing women that we have in sports now, and hopefully we can all learn a little something. Please make sure to subscribe to my podcast, Leveling the Playing Field, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and with my guys at radioinfluence.com.